Okay, we're going to begin here on the top of Zayin Amud Aleph. The Gemara is continuing to discuss one of the braytot that we brought yesterday. The braytot yesterday said, "Sfekot nichnasim l'dir l'hitaser," that the sfekot, where it said there was a sefek b'chor, goes into the crowd to be counted towards maaser. So what we're going to investigate now is, what does that mean? What is the sefek that we're discussing, and what are the sfekot that are found in that braytot? So that's the Gemara begins, and third line down, Amalei Rav Acha Midifti Ravina, my sfekot. What's the sfekot we're talking about? Ilim of sfek b'chorot, if we're talking about sfek of a regular b'chor, I mean the three top possibilities of what a b'chor is speaking about. We can have a b'chor adam, which obviously is not relevant over here, and that gets redeemed, or the b'chor adam gets redeemed by the family, by the father, from the Kohen. Number two is a b'chor behemat tehora, that is domesticated kosher animals, that the firstborn goes to the Kohen. And that has to be given to the Kohen if it's a tam, if it's a proper animal without any mum in it, it's brought as a korban. If not, then we wait for a mum in it, or if there is a mum in it, then it becomes the mamon of the Kohen. And the third possibility, what a b'chor is, peter chamor, which is the firstborn chamor. There, you don't give the chamor to the Kohen. The firstborn chamor, you exchange for a seh. That seh is then given to the Kohen. If you don't give the seh to the Kohen, then the chamor is killed. So what b'chor, safek b'chor, we were discussing over here? So that says, ilim a safek b'chor, if we're talking about a b'chor behemah, we're talking about a regular b'chor behemah, it says, he kodesh. It says, v'asiriyah kodesh l'Hashem. The tenth one will be kodesh l'Hashem, amar rachmano v'lo shivar kadosh. It has to be that now, when you are making into the maaser, that's what's infusing this animal's kedusha, but not that there pre-exists kedusha. And if it's a safek b'chor behemah, then there's a possibility that there was kedusha in this animal prior to this point. Ella must be Safek Pijon Petr Chamor. Must be that we're talking about a Safek Pijon, the redemption of a Petr Chamor. What's the redemption of a Petr Chamor? It's a Seh. So that said, that you use to redeem the Petr Chamor, we have a Safek about whether this Chamor is really a firstborn or not. So in order to take away the problem of Kedusha, taking away the issue of it being Kadosh or need for it to be killed, you redeem it onto a Seh. That Seh you do not give to the Kohen because Amotzi Michavero Lavaraya. So the Kohen has to prove that the chamor was actually really a firstborn that he's entitled to the seh. So in the interim, the balim keep the seh and they use it as their own because there's no reason for them to give the seh to the kohen. Ucha de Rav Nachman, Dar Rav Nachman, Rav Bavua, Yisrael sheish lo asaras safek pitrei chamor. Yisrael that has 10 chamors that are 10 donkeys that are a safek whether they're the firstborn or not. B'toch veto. So what does he do? Mafrish alem asaras in. He takes 10 seh. He redeems them for a goat or a sheep, and then he takes those redemptions, which are all misafek, umasran, and then he puts them into the corral and takes off maaser for them, vehin shalom, and they remain in his possession. So if that's the safek that we're discussing over here, the safek that we say goes into the corral to be nesar, that is exactly our case. This is the case, and this is how it's defined, meaning that the case of Rav Nachman bar Amar Rabba Baravua, which is that it's a case where we have numerous Petr Chamors, or Safek Petr Chamors, that we're exchanging for Se'in, and those Se'in we take all together and we put them to the corral to be Ne'esar. Tosfos points out there are numerous questions on this. First of all, the Gemara in Bechorot says that you can use one Se'ah to redeem multiple Petr Chamors. So why over here does he need 10 to redeem the 10? He should just take one Se'ah and redeem all the Petr Chamor. Number two is, right, we could have learned this out from the Brisa itself. I mean, what is the statement of Rav Nachman adding over here? The statement of Rav Nachman says, oh, if it's a safek, you take maaser off of it. But that's in the Brisa already. Safekot nichnasim l'dili taser. So why is it, what is Rav Nachman's statement adding that was not in the, or we did not know from the Brisa? And also, the last line in the statement of Rav Nachman is, v'hin shalo, they belong to the Baalim. What's the alternative? I mean, why shouldn't they belong to him? I mean, that if here's the safek here. The safek makes them into a safek petr chamor, which the seh then would have to, if it was really a petr chamor, the seh would go to the kohen. The fact that here, we give it to the Yisrael to keep, that's already indicative. The fact that he can take maaser off of them, that's indicative of his ownership. If he didn't have ownership over here, then he couldn't put them into maaser, he couldn't be mafrish maaser from them. So it's obvious, if we're allowing him to take off maaser, that they are hin shalo. And if it is really maaser, then of course they're his, because maaser goes to the balim. So does the result of Svitzarachim and what the real Chiddush of Rav Nachman's statement is. Nevertheless, what we do learn from here is that when the Brisa before said a Sfeikot Nihlas and Adili Taser, that Safek is this Safek described by Rav Nachman, which is a Safek Peter Pitre Chamor. Right now, Gemara says, well, okay, now that we've gone through all this, Mai Havi La Demisuto, we still never answer the question, what's the din of this bathhouse? In this bathhouse where there are two parties arguing over the bathhouse, one of them is Makdish, or Mekadish, the bathhouse in its entirety, and then the Rabbanim were Purishman there. Did he have the right to be Makdish the whole bathhouse? So what's the din? There was a case that came before Rav Chista, and from Rav Chista took it over to Rav Huna. Upash domina. The Amar Rav Nachman, they brought it down, or they tried through from another statement of Rav Nachman. Kol mamon she'en yachol otzio b'dayanim, hekdisho enu kadosh. Any money that you cannot remove through dayanim, that you cannot, in court, if you were to bring the item or the dispute to court, and you would win and you'd get the money out, then you can be makdishit. If you are unable to remove that money or to win that money in court, then you are not allowed to be makdishit. So the implications from this, had he been able to go to court and remove the money, hekdesho kadosh, afagav de la afke, even though he never actually took it out. So just the possibility of taking full ownership over an object, meaning if you have the right through the court system to get this object into your possession, that's enough to allow you to make it kadosh. Not that you actually have to go to court, but the possibility, the mere possibility, or the afsharut, that you could go to court and do it, gives you the power, the ability to be makdishit. So now, we have Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Is that really, that statement of Nachman, is that really so conclusive or concrete? Why? In Rabbi Yochanan, we learned this in Baba Kama a number of times in Kedushin. Gazal v'lunit yashua banim. If you have a gazlan that comes along and steals an object, and the balim haven't given up hope of getting it back. So now you have an object that is in no man's land. The owners, the original balim, still own it because they were not mitzayish from it. The gazlan doesn't own it because the balim didn't have yayush. But on the other hand, the balim can get a hold of it because it's in the hands of the gazlan. Right? Shneim en yochlin lakdisho. Neither of them are able to make it hekdesh. Ze lefi sheino shalo. Levi ze lefi sheino b'shuto. So what's the failing over here, according to Yochanan, is that in order to be makdish something, you need two conditions. One condition is you must own the item. The second condition is you actually must control the item. It must be in your possession and in your control in order to be makdishit. So in this case, each one of these parties, the gazlan and the nigzal, are lacking one of those two conditions. The nigzal, the original balim, they own it, but they lack control over the item. They lack control over the item because it's in the hands of the gazlan. So therefore, they cannot be makdishit. On the other hand, the gazlan can't be makdishit because, yes, he has control over it, but he doesn't own it. So he's unable to make it hektesh. If that's the case, if we believe that Rav Nachman's statement is true, that whenever you could remove it in Beis Din, it becomes yours, then why is it not true here? The Nigzal, the Balim that own it, they could get this object back from the Gazlan in court. If they could get it back from the Gazlan in court, then the Balim really own the item. They really control the item. If they really control the item, then they should be able to be Makdishit. So in our case of the bathhouse, it should be the same thing. Even, let's say for instance that he can prove in court that it really belongs to him, and therefore he should have been able to be Makdishit, but he still has the failure of Rabbi Yochanan, which is that you have two conditions. Not only do you have to be able to own it, like Rav Nachman says, even if you don't actually own it today, but you have the ability to extract it in court, but you need a second condition, what is it, Birshuto, that it's in your possession. So the Mesuta, the bathhouse, will fail over here because it's not in your possession. So Gemara says, Misavarat de Mesuta Metalpin Eskinen, who says that we're talking about a bathhouse that is movable. Rashi talks about the gigit, we're talking about either ledge barrels or a bath that can be moved. I mean, we're not talking about movable or non-real property over here that they're arguing about. Maybe they're arguing about Mesuta Mekarke Eskinen, we're dealing with real property, a bathhouse that is real property that does not move. Because then, if he can extract it in court, it's automatically in his possession. Why? Because karka doesn't move. Land doesn't move. So, automatically, if you own it, you're in control of it. You're in control of it because the karka is present and available for you to take or to do whatever you want with it. So, therefore, it will be a good question over here. The real question at hand is whether the party who is makdishit has the ability to extract it in court. If he has the ability to extract it in court, even though he hadn't done it yet, he hadn't gone to court yet and he hadn't removed it, he has the ability to be makdishit because he has fulfilled both conditions. Number one, he owns it even though he does not in his possession yet because he hasn't gone to court. That's Rav Nachman's principle. If you can go to court and extract it, it belongs to you. Number two, it's in his control. What do you mean it's in his control? It's not here. The other guy's arguing with him about it. That's the case of karka. As soon as he gets ownership over it, he has control of it, because wherever the karka is, it's automatically in his possession. Because kol heichad ita b'shut marei kaima kar, the car can't exile it. The car can never be stolen, and therefore wherever it is, it's still in the possession of the original owner. So that will be a good answer. And the only thing we'll have to verify to know whether his hekdesh was successful or not is whether he could have extracted in Bezin. If he could have extracted in Bezin, then his hekdesh was successful. If he could not extract it in Bezin later on, then his hekdesh was not successful. Just a note over here, Rabbi Akiva questions the Gemara's differentiation between karka and metaltolin over here, because that shouldn't be really the definition or differentiation between the cases, because what's the reason karka works? Because karka ain't an exilet, it's always in the control or the possession of the Balim. But the same is true of the Gezel over here, or the Metaltolin that are over here. In this case of the Metaltolin, we have a case where they're arguing about the Metaltolin, but not that one of them walked off of it or made a Kinyan on it. By Gezlan, he walks off, he has a Kinyan on it, he has it in his possession, so therefore the Balim don't have control. But over here, where the item is still in front of us, nobody's made a Kinyan on it, they're just making a claim on it, then the item should also be, wherever it is, it should be Beshute Demarikame, it should be in the possession of the owner, and therefore he should have both ownership and control, and should be able to be Makdishit. So the Rav Akiva Eger leaves that as a Tzarachion, why the Gemara differentiated between Metaltlin and Karka, when it could have even in Metaltlin explained the case over here. Maybe they're just giving paradigms, meaning anything in Metaltlin that looked like Karka means that there is still within the control of the original owner that he could be Makdish. And Metaltlin, meaning Metaltlin that looked like Metaltlin, that they're no longer in his possession, like they're with the Gazlan, that he'd like Rabbi Yochanan's case, that he doesn't have control of it, that he can't be Makdish. So now the Gemara moves on to a new case. Tani Rav Tzvichah bar Marava, Kamei de Rabavua. Shnayim adukim b'talit, two people are holding on to a talit. Zenu talad makom shiado magat, zenu talad shamagom shiado magat. Each one takes up to the place where he is grasp on the item. Vashachu kim b'shaveh. And whatever is left between them, they divide evenly. Simchavilei Rabbi Abou, Rabbi says, u'b'shvu'ah, that they have to take a shvu'ah on this. Tosos points out over here that the gears, there were other girsot in the Gemara, the shar, af, that they used to have a girsot that it wasn't just that it's b'shvu'ah, but a shar b'shvu'ah, that the rest is with the shvu'ah, which would be indicative from the Gemara that only the part that is in dispute, up to where they hold with their hands, they don't have to take a shvu'ah on it. Only the part that they're going to split do they have to take a shvu'ah on it. Tosos says he does not think that the girsot is right, he thinks the girsot is incorrect. He thinks that you should remove the word sha'ar, and that the shvuah is on the entirety of the object. Whatever you're going to take a shvuah, both the part that you're holding, as well as the part that is not being held, which is going to be split between you, because the takana, either way, whatever the reason for the takana is, it's relevant whether you're giving him the item because he's holding it, or because we're splitting whatever they can't reach, or they're not holding on to. The takana, which forced the shvuah, either because of Yochanan, because we don't want everybody going willy-nilly and taking things, or because of the reason given by Abaye, who says that Chashin and Shemes Samak Milva Yishana Yishtol Avlav, that he has an old Milva, an outstanding obligation towards him. In either case, the Shua Shayach, whether he's holding it or not holding it, Tosafot says the Shua is an entire item. The Rambam says that it's not the case. The Rambam, other Rishonim disagree and say that it's only a De Gilgul. They have to take a Shua on the centerpiece that's not being grabbed, and then by a Gilgul Shua will also make them take a Shvuah on the part that they're holding. But they're Rishonim that support Tosafot's position, and they're Rishonim like the Rambam who believe it's only a De Gilgul Shua. Alright, nevertheless, we have a case here which seems to be different than our Mishnah, which is that until the point you hold, you keep, and then it doesn't matter if that's even or not even, but then the part that's in between, that you're both not in grasp or in holding, that part you split evenly. So, what are you going to do with our Mishnah? Our Mishnah says they just split the item equally. And our Mishnah never makes that qualification that you take up to the point you're holding. What's the case in our Mishnah? So, our Mishnah is a case where they're not holding the entire beggar, they're not holding it by its edges, by the little strings at the end. So both of them are just holding onto the edges. So the entire beggar, the entire talit, is in dispute because neither of their magat, neither of their control, what they're holding, reaches into the beggar itself. And that's why we split the entire beggar, because they're just holding the edges. So Amar Rav Mishar, Shesh Mamina, Hai Sudra, Kim the Tafis Be Shalosh Shalosh, Krimbin and Dei, the Tanareu, Kedeman the Posik, Dmei Vikani. So now, Rav Mishar says over here, well, we can conclude from this, or based on this Mishnah, the way you're explaining this Mishnah, that in order to make a kinyan, for instance, to take possession of an item, you do not have to hold the entire item. You don't have to pick up the entire item. You just have to have a grasp on a portion that is significant. What's significant? When it comes to a beged or a sudra, for instance, here where he's going to do a kinyan chalipin. Kinyan chalipin, he wants to take hold of a handkerchief in order to have a kinyan take place in a sale. So then he takes a kinyan, he's kone, the handkerchief, And from that, his whatever metallic, whatever objects he's trying to sell goes to the possession of the other party. Then does he have to pick up the entire, does he have to hold the entire handkerchief? Or can he just grab a portion of the handkerchief? Well, from our Mishnah, it sounds like you just need to have a hold of the edge, a little piece of it. And how much? Up to shalosh shlosh etzbaot. 3 by 3 etzbaot, because why? You need a kli. In order to have a kinyan chalipin, one of the requirements of a kinyan chalipin is that the item or the object that you do the kinyan chalipin on is actually a kli. And what's the minimum kli by a beged? The minimum kli by a beged is shalosh al shalosh etzbaot. That's in dinei tuma. That's the minimum amount of a beged that's classified to be, or can still retain tuma, or receive tuma, because it can be used for a patch. So since that's already a significant piece of beged, if you're holding that, that already gives you a kinyan on the entire sudra. So, and then it will be considered a tanda re'ehu, that there will be an exchange. Come on, the pasuk demei v'koni. It's as if you set the price and you did the kinyan, that will be a valid kinyan chalipin. Why is this different than Rav Chista? Why is the fact that you have a kinyan on a portion of the handkerchief enough? I mean, over here, damar Rav Chista, get biyada. A person gives a get to his wife, umishicha biyado, but the get has strings attached, right? Literally, a string attached to the get. Im yachol natko, if the husband can pull the get back with the string that he has in his hands, udavi etzlo, eno migureshet, she's not divorced. Bimlav, if not, migureshet, then she's divorced. Sumer says, why is that different than our case over here? If you say that simply any type of hold on an object gives you a kinyan on the object, then why isn't the woman's hold on this object enough to have her make a kinyan on the get and it be hers? Even though he can pull it back with the string, nevertheless, her grabbing a portion of the get should be, or her holding a portion of the get should be significant enough or sufficient to create a kinyan that the get is valid. Sumer says, no. Hotam kritut bein in the record. Over there, in the case of get, you need a full severing of the relationship or any ties between the husband and the wife, and that you don't have. The fact that he can pull the get back, that means that it's not a full severing, a full kritut that's being done over here. When we say that he gives the get to the woman, it has to be the get without him having any control or connection to the get. Over here, by kinyan, we just need it to be given. And that is, it's been given. The object's been given. Doesn't mean that he has to, the other party has no touching on it, he has to have to take full control of the object. He just needs to have some sort of netina, some sort of reception of the item from the other, from the machna to the kona. That can be done by just a small piece of the beged. Rashi has an interesting interpretation here of what kritut b'inan is. He says, very good, that kritut means that they must have to have like a physical separation between them. The fact that this string is still there means that they are still attached, that the husband and wife are physically attached because of the string that joins them together. I don't know if you have to go that far to say that what the Gemara demands over here of kritut means that we need to have a physical severing of the relationship, but you could simply say that kritut, the demand for kritut in a get, means that the husband has no control or no connection to the get itself anymore, whether through a tznai, whether through a string, or anything else. So that severing of that is what, that severance that we demand is only, or severing of the relationship that we demand means that he must be totally natuk, removed from it. Not that we need him to be physically removed from the woman, but physically, right, detached from the get that is doing the kritut. Alright, now, Tosos also points out over here that, and they did it in Gittin as well, that Tosos points out that what is the case over here, that the woman's holding it? Like, how does the woman get control over the item here? Meaning that if her hands are open, and he put the get into her hands when it's open, and he has the string here, right, and then afterwards she closes her hands on the get. What happens then? She puts it into her hands, and her hands are open, and she closes her hands into the get. Now he can't pull it back. Is she konen in that case or not? Tosa says, no, she cannot be konen in that instance. Why? Because at the moment that he placed it into her hands were open, and he could have pulled it back with a string. The fact that she later closes her hands on the get, that doesn't do anything. Why? Because there's a requirement. We saw this in Margit, and there's a requirement that the natan be adat, that the husband must give the get to her, and now that she takes the get for herself. She can't pick it up off the floor and be konen it. Rather, he has to give it to her, and she has to actually get it, receive it from him. So over here, when he gives it to her and places it in her hand, and he has a string, it's still within his possession. And then when she grabs it, it's not like he's placing it into her hands. She's just taking it now and holding it. Now when she holds it, you're right, he can no longer pull it back, so she's making a kinyan in it. But her kinyan now is in a time period, a point when his netina is done already. His placing it to get in her hands is done. So even in that case where she grabs it afterwards, then there is no kinyan. If that's the case, then what's the case here where he can't pull it back with the string? If he's unable to pull it back with the string, why does she have a kinyan over here? So fine, he placed it into her hands. But what's the issue? I mean, what's stopping him from bringing it back at this point in time? If it's the fact that she closed her hands again, then again, that kinyan's not a kinyan that's valid to create the get over here. So The Tosa explains the case. The case is that the woman already had her hand clasped, and the husband stuffs the get into her clasped hand. So the only question here is the clasp that she has, or the grip that she has on the get now from him stuffing it in, is it strong enough that he can't pull it back with a string, or is it not strong enough that he can still pull it back in the string? And that would be the question, because then we have him directly giving it to the woman into a clasp or a gripped hand, and therefore the kinyan is happening immediately when he's placing it in. So he has a natan, and she has a reception. She's konet immediately. If she's konet immediately, then the only question is, can he still pull it out of her grip? If she can pull it out of her, if he can pull it out of her grip, then it's not a kinyan, because he can still pull it out. If her grip is tight enough that he can't pull it back, then it's a kinyan on the spot. The Rabbeinu Tam explains the case differently, just says it's a question of a heavy get. Get can be written on many different materials. What happens if it's a very heavy material? The question about the string being able to pull it is, how light is the get? If it's a heavy get and he can't pull it back with the string, then there's a kinyan. If there was a get given that was light enough that he could pull it back with the string, then there is no kinyan over here. That's the way Rabbeinu Tam explains the case. So, Gemara says, Amar Rava, imaita talit miz hevet chokim. Rava says that if it's a gold-plated talit, that they split it. Pshita, of course they split it. No tricha, dekai dava be mitzoy. Cases where the gold is right in the middle. So Gemara says, ha-nami pshita. What else? What'd you do? Of course you'd split it down the middle. Gemara says, no tricha, dimikarv de gavi dechad. That it goes closer, the gold plating is closer to one of the grips of one of the individuals. One of the individuals holding the talit on one side, the other on the other side. And, now, they're both taken. So you would think, since the gold is closer to one side, that the person's holding on that side should get. He would say, divide it on my direction, divide it across the horizontal, so I'll keep the piece that has the gold plating on it, and you won't get it, because it's closer to me. It's Kamash Malan, that's what Rava teaches us. Why do you think you should split it this way? Split it the other way. Meaning, why split it along the horizontal line so that all gold goes to you? Split along the vertical line. If we split along the vertical line, then the gold plating will split evenly between us. So that's what Rava comes to teach. The Chiddush Rava comes to teach us that you have a right to make that claim. It doesn't matter who the object or the object that's not being held in their hand. It doesn't matter in that area that is not held by either party that we say chokim. Doesn't matter if there are significant parts or parts that have more value that are closer to one individual or the other. We split the whole thing evenly, right, to ensure that both parties get exactly half, or that they get 50% of what's being held at that point. The Gemara continues now with a new case. Tarabban and Shnaima Dukim Bishtar. Two individuals are holding on to a document, a loan document. Malve, the creditor, says, Omer Shaliu, it's mine. Vina found me many. And it fell from me. What's up, David? Now I found it. Meaning that I'm the creditor. This is the loan that I've outstanding with this individual. And this is the document of that documentation of that loan. And I lost it. Now I found it again. Valve Amar, the debtor, says, Shalcha, you're right. There was a loan outstanding. Shalcha, uperativ lecha. But I paid it back to you. It's kaim ashtar b'chotnav divrei Rabbi. Rabbi says that you have to be mekayim the star with its signatories. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer Yochloku. They divide it. Now I'm going to leave this ambiguous right now because the Gemara is going to explain all the positions. Now Faliyad Dayan, it sounds like from here that if it came into the possession of the Dayan, lo yotziu olamit. He won't give it back either to the Mavra Lovet forever. Yosi Omer Yehu b'chazkato. It remains in the chazaka whoever it's with. So Amamar. Now the Gemara is going to explain this right. Mar itkayim ashtar b'chotmav. The Gavile Malva Kule. So, if that's, what is the explanation of Yitkayim Ashtar B'chutmav? That the Shtar should be verified by its signatories. Does that mean then the Malva, once we've verified the Shtar, the Malva will be able then to make a full claim on the Shtar and collect all the money? What about our Mishnah? Our Mishnah Shnayim Ochzin says they split it. So why in our Mishnah with the Talit do they split it? And over here by the loan document, we're going to say it all goes to the Malva. So Amar of Nachman, B'mikuyam, Divrei HaKol Yachloku. If the shtar is already verified, meaning that the signatories have been verified by Beis Din, and it's now a shtar mekuyam, then everybody agrees that they're both holding it. It's exactly like the case in our Mishnah, which is that shnayim ochzim, and they'll split the shtar. Pi plige, when they do argue, what the argument between Rabbi and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is, v'she'ein mekuyam, when the shtar has yet to be verified, or the signatures on the shtar have yet to be verified. Rabbi savar mudu b'shtar shekadvo tzarich lekaymo. That someone who admits to the fact that they do owe money, or they did owe money, and the shtar is a valid shtar. So here the lova, the debtor, is agreeing that this shtar is a valid shtar. He just says it was paid off. Even when the lova, when the debtor agrees that this is a shtar, we still say you have to verify the signatures. And if they do verify the signatures, then they will divide it. Then it'll go back to the place of Yachloku. V'lo, right? If they are not mikayim lo polik, they won't divide it. My time up. Chas b'lamahu. Then it's a worthless document. a worthless document because we're unable to verify the document to give it veracity. If you can't give it veracity, then you can't collect money with this document. So based on this, if the star was a valid star because they had been verified, the signatures had been verified already, then it'll be like our Mishnah, Shnei Mochsim will split it. If the signatures had not yet been verified, and therefore the star is basically a worthless piece of paper until it is verified, even though the Lova, even though the debtor says it's a valid star, that's not significant or sufficient enough, we still need the verification of these signatures to make it a valid star. Until, if it's verified, then it'll become a valid star, and then it'll go back to being like the original case of where it's a star mekuyam and we split it. If they're unable to verify the signatures, then this star is worthless, and then nobody will collect, meaning that the mava won't get any money here. So now, man mekashave le haishtara, because the star is worthless, the only reason we can believe that the star has any veracity to it is because the lova himself is the one who says that the star is a valid star. Lova, he's the one who says it. Hakamar de priya. And based on, if we're going to believe him to say that this is a valid star, we also have to believe him that it's parua, that the star was already paid off. Basically, this is similar to a case of a pesha asu or pesha hitir. The person who gives veracity to the star is also the person who says it's paid off. If that's the case, then we can't do anything with this star. We can't allow the malva to collect with such a star. Rabbi Shimon on the other hand believes that if the debtor agrees that the star is a valid star, then you don't have to go and verify the star anymore. The lova's admission, the debtor's admission, is sufficient to make it into a valid star. So if that's the case, even if they don't go out then and verify the signatures, they're going to split it because the star is a valid star. There are two ways, according to Rabbi Shimon Galil, to make a star valid. Either you verify the signatures, in that case the din is yachloku, or you have the debtor admit that it is a valid star. In that case as well, since it's a valid star, once it's a valid star, there also be a yachloku, they will split it, because we do not need any additional information to make it into a valid star. And since that's the case, it means that the star, the validation of the star, according to Rabbi Shimon Galil, is al pi edav, through the edim themselves, right? Therefore, the loveh himself is not believed to say parati. In the case of Rabbi, since the star has no validity without the signatures being verified, when the debtor comes and speaks up, he's the only thing that gives veracity to the document. If he's the only thing that gives veracity to the document, then he can also say parati, that I paid it. On the other hand, according to Rabbi Shimon Galil, since the document has tokif, as soon as the lova admits there was such a loan or such a document existed, we don't say that the lova is what gives veracity to the document. It's rather the signatories on the document are what give the document veracity because of the admission of the lova. So therefore, now the document can stand on its own, and the lova then doesn't have a right to say parati. So in that case, it'll become like a verified document. A verified document, we just said, is yachloku. So that'll be the first part of the brace that we just brought. Explain the positions of Rabbi and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Now we need to explain the next lines of the Mishnah. Next line in the verse says, if it falls into the hands of Dayan, lo yutzio lamit, he won't allow it to be given to the Malva the Lova ever. So I says, Maishnali yada Dayan. What's so special about the Dayan versus a regular person? Why is the Dayan holding it any different? So Amar Rav Achi Kamar. That doesn't mean that the yada Dayan means that the Dayan's one who found it, but rather it's already passed through the hands of the judges. What does it mean it's passed through the hands of the judges? That the document's already been verified as a henpek. Henpek is a verification by Beis Din of a star to say this star is a valid star. So then, v'achar shematzah star shenafal liyad dayan, a person finds a third party that finds a document that already has a henpek, already has a verification by Beis Din on it, then lo yutzio lamit. Then he should never allow it to be given back to the malva lelova. Velo mi baye lo kata behenpek. Right, certainly, not in a case when there was no henpek written in it, ikla meikmar katav lo vot lo lava. In a case when there is no verification by Beis Din, then certainly you don't give it back to the malva and the lova. Why not? Because maybe he wrote the document because he planned on borrowing the money, but he never ended up borrowing the money. Ela filu katav behenpek di mikuyam. Even if he writes, even if there is attached to this document, or stamped on this document, the verification of Beis Din, which means that clearly there was a loan, lo yachzir. Why? The chashin and the piron. Because we worry about the fact that it might have been paid off already. The fact that the star mekuyam, if it's a star mekuyam, then we should worry about the fact that the lova owes the money to the malva. But we see also another side to this. Maybe the lova already paid him back. And if the lova paid him back, why should we give this document back to the malva? Therefore, we won't give it neither to the malva nor to the lova. Rabbi Yossi Amar, Rabbi Yehuda Chezkato. Right, that it stands, the the document stands here as a document of loan, and it's been verified by Beis Din, and therefore the loan is outstanding. We don't worry about paying off. Why? Because had he really paid it off, he would have taken the document and ripped it up right away. The fact that he didn't rip it up is indication that the loan is still in force, and he has to pay it back. Mar says, "V'lo chayish Rabbi Yosi the Pirum." Is that really true that Rabbi Yosi ignores the fact that there's a possibility that someone paid back the loan? V'atanya, don't we have a bais? Matzah shtark tuba b'shuk. Someone finds a shtark tuba in the shuk. Bizman shem bal modeh yachzir l'isha. If the husband admits that he had written a tuba to his wife and it was missing, it was lost, then you can return it to the woman. In bal modeh lo yachzir lo lizev lo lizeh. The Baal does not admit to the fact that there's a shtark tuba outstanding, then you don't give it back neither to the Baal nor to the woman. Rabbi Yosi Omer, Oda Tachet Bala, Rabbi Yosi qualifies that, he says no. Well, it really depends on what's the status of this woman. If this woman is still married to this man, then you have Zilisha, give it back to the woman. Because the underlying assumption is that he wanted to pay back, or he wanted to pay off the ktubah. As long as he's still married, there's no reason for the Baal to pay off the woman. So if she's still married to him, we can give the ktubah back to her because what is her chashash of pirun? On the other hand, nit arma, nit kasha, if she was widowed or divorced, lo yachzir lo lezev lo lezev, you don't give back neither to the Baal's inheritors nor to her. Why? Because there we are chashash to pirun. Now that he either divorced her, he might have paid it off, or if she was widowed, maybe she already collected from the estate, or the husband set aside karka that she collected from. If that's the case, then we see that Rabbi Yosi is choshesh the pirum. In the case of nitgarsha and nitalma, in the case of divorce and widowing, we see that Rabbi Yosi says, we worry about pirum, we don't give it back. So how come in our case of the brayta, we say Rabbi Yosi doesn't worry about pirum, and we hand the document back to the malveh, and yet over here by the ktubah, we don't hand the ktubah back to the woman and say that it wasn't paid off. So Mar says, ipuch, flip the positions over here. Flip the positions in the bracket that we brought before. Nafali yada dayan lo yotzio olomit. Divir Rabbi Yosi. Rabbi Yosi believes that once it falls into the hands of an individual after it was verified by Beis Din, don't give it back to either party, neither the malveh nor the loveh. Why? Because we are choshesh the pirun. Similar to Rabbi Yosi's position in the case of ketubah. And Chachamim say no, it stays b'chezkato, that it remains outstanding alone, because we're not choshesh the pirun. If it was paid off, he should have ripped it up. Mar says, okay, well then you took care of Rabbi Yosi, but now you left the Rabbanan in trouble. Why? Yochi, kasha Rabbanan under Rabbanan. Now the Rabbanan is going to be a problem. Why? Because in the Braisa, that we said that the Rabbanan say that you give it back to the Malveh, and yet over here in our Braisa about Ketubah, they say only when the husband agrees to give the Ketubah back. But that means if the husband doesn't agree, we don't give the Ketubah back to the husband. It means we're choshesh the pirun, and we are worried about being paid off. So Mar says, shtark Ketubah, kula Rabbi Yosi. Don't worry, no, we're going to leave, but that's right, the Braisa is correct now, the way we reread the Braisa, which is Rabbi Yosi believes you don't give it to the Malveh, and the Chachamim do believe you give it to the Malveh. What about this Braisa of Ketubah, that we have the Rabbanan, who are the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yosi? We're going to say, no, that the whole Braisa of Ketubah is Kula Rabbi Yosi. That whole Braisa is written by Rabbi Yosi, and it's missing words. If the Baal does not admit that this is a shtark tubah that he had written and that she's missing her shtark tubah, lo lezev lo lezev, we don't give it to him. Then it qualifies that statement. Ba me devarim amurim, when is that true? Shnit arma nit garsha. That's if she was divorced or widowed, where there is a chashash lepir on. Aval odah tachet bala yachzir leisha. Then he gives it back to the woman. Devar Rabbi Yosi. She Rabbi Yosi omer, odah tachet bala yachzir leisha. Because when she is still married, we give it back to the woman because we don't assume it was paid off. Nit arma nit garsha yachzir lo lezev lo lezev. We don't give back to either party because then we do our choshesh the pirun like Rabbi Yosi's shita. Therefore, Rabbi Yosi will be the shita. So Rabbi Yosi in our brayta here, which deals with the malveh and loveh, will say we don't give it to the malveh because we're choshesh for pirun. In the case of ketubah, Rabbi Yosi also say do not give it back to the husband unless the husband admits that it is clearly a valid ketubah. Don't give it back to the woman because we are choshesh the pirun. But Rabbi Yosi says, qualifies that statement, says, well, that's only true if the woman was divorced or widowed, because then we can't assume that maybe there was payment. But if he's still married to her, then we don't make that assumption that it was paid off. There's no reason to believe that it was paid off. And that would be Rabbi Yosi l'shitato, that we are choshesh in the piron, right, in cases where it makes sense to be choshesh. The Rabbanan and I believe we're not choshesh the piron, but the Rabbanan only appear in our embrace here by Malveh and Loveh. They don't appear in the embrace of Ketubah, because that's all Rabbi Yosi. So Rabbi Papa says, leave Rabbi Yosi in the Rabbanan's position in place. So that would mean that the Rabbanan believe by Malveh and Loveh you don't give it to anyone. And Rabbi Yossi believes he give it back to the Malveh because he's not kosher, he's the Pirun. What are you going to do about the Bright of Tuba? Was a question. Rabbi Yossi, well, I'll explain it to you. Rabbi Yossi, the Divayim de Rabbanan Kamarlehu, he's speaking according to you, Rabbanan, your Shita, according to your Shita, at least believe like this. Now, Rabbi Yossi holds no chashash to Pirun. But, according to you, the Rabbanan, the Didi, Yafilinit Amar Nitgarsha, not a little chashin in the Pirun. According to me, even if she was divorced or widowed, I don't worry about Pirun at all. Like we saw by Malvin Movin, that'll be the case here too. Lididhu, according to you, say we are kosher to Pirun, we only give it back when the husband admits that it's a valid ktubah. Oda Liniyat, at least admits me, but Oda Tachet Bala, well, she's still under her husband, she's still married, the Yachzir Leisha, the Labar Pironi. Give it back to the woman, because there's no reason the husband should have paid off the woman over here. Ramalei Rabbanan, Imor Tzrayatapsa. No, there is a possibility of Pirun even before she's divorced. Maybe the husband set aside money bags, set aside payment for the woman even before she was divorced. She didn't want to have to go through the process of claiming from the estate or getting it from the Yitomim or extracting her ketubah. So therefore, he gives her money to put away up front that will be used to pay off her ketubah. And therefore, there is a possibility of Pirun even when she's still married. And that's why they say we don't agree with you, Rabbi Yossi. Okay, Rabbi Yossi, we don't agree with you at all because you say no chashash Pirun, we say chashash Pirun. But even within that context, when we say we're choshes to Pirun, we say it even when the woman is still married to the husband. Because even though generally you would assume it's not paid off, nevertheless, there's a possibility that the husband gave her money to hold on to pay for a ketubah, even though he's not paying off the ketubah, but gave her set aside money that would be the payment, future payment for her ketubah. If that's the case, then we could be choshes to Pirun even before the fact that she's divorced or widowed. Rina maradolam ipuch kamaita. No, flip the first brayta, flip the brayta of Malvin Lova. So now, if that's the case, what about our brayta by ketubah? Brayta of ketubah, when we flipped it, according to the first try of the Gemara to do this, we flipped the original brayta of Malvin Lova, and then we said ketubah is a problem to Rabbanah, and we switched the brayta of ketubah to be all Rabbi Yossi. Says you don't have to do that, but time of the Rabbanan hocham ishum tachashin l'shtek ketubot. The problem over here is not that they're running choshes in the Pirun. We know that from our Brayta. If we flip the positions of Rabbi Yossi and the Chumim, that means the Chumim believe we're not choshes the Pirun and we give it back to the Malveh. How come by the Ketubah they say only if the Baal agrees, only if the husband agrees do we give it back? That's a problem because we're choshes the two Ketubot, shtei Ketubot. We're worried about the fact that there might be two Ketubot outstanding over here. Maybe the husband, after the woman lost it, the husband wrote her an additional Ketubah. And now we're going to give back to her the Ketubah. Now they're really two ketubot because the husband replaced the ketubah that she lost. So that's the case. If the husband agrees that she doesn't have a ketubah now, then we can give it back to her. But if the husband doesn't agree, then maybe she already has a ketubah because he rewrote the ketubah for her when it was lost. And now we're not going to allow her to get a hold of this ketubah again because maybe then she'll have two ketubot. Rabbi Yossi says we're not choshesh for two ketubot. That's an unusual case, and therefore we're not choshesh for that issue. So the machloket and the bright by ketubah is different from the machloket by Malvin Lover. By Malvin Lover, the machloket about choshen the piron and choshen the piron. Do we worry about being paid off or not being paid off? By ketubah, the issue is whether there's two ketubot or one ketubah. Tosafos just points out in these cases over here that when the Baal agrees that we do give the ketubah back to the woman and we're not choshesh the ketunya, we're not worried about them being aiding and abetting each other in a crime to basically extract the money back from the encumbered property or property that he sold by having the woman lose the ketubah and then rewrite the ketubah or redate the ketubah, whatever they are trying to do. In this case, we're not worried about that because in general, the mana matayim, it also makes a statement that mana matayim, the 100 or 200 that a woman's entitled to in a ketubah, mishtab de mine erusin. They're already mishubad to the woman from the time they're engaged, right, the time there's erusin, apalo ketubah. Even when there's no ketubah written, the 100 or 200 are already, already she has an in lien on his property or his possessions for that. The erusin kala idluhu. Because a erusin is something that has public knowledge or is well known. So therefore, buyers already will know to stay away from his property or at least leave over enough property at that point in time that she can collect her ketubah from it, at least 100 or 200. They may not know about the Tosefet ketubah, but at least they know about the Kor ketubah, which for sure is going to take place after he gets married to her. So they know to avoid it because that's something that is known, a well-known, publicized issue. So it says that we don't worry about ketunya because from Erusin forward, she has a lien. From that point forward, so then, and it's Kali, everybody knows when the Erusin was, people are aware of it, and because of that, we don't have to worry about them trying to cheat other people out, because there's a well-documented, publicized time that they got engaged. From that moment forward, there was a lien, and there's nothing to cheat about over here. Now, Dosis also says that the explanation of the second brayta, why does Ravina flip their positions in our brayta of Malvin Lova and then explain the brayta of ketubah about shtei ketubot and one ketubah? Why not leave their positions in place and then say, according to Rabbi Yossi, we're kosher to shtei ketubot? That you can't say because if we're worried about two ketubot, then why do we say when she's still married that we give her back the ketubah? Why should we give her back the ketubah when she's still married? Being married should have no influence on whether he wrote her a second ketubah or not. I mean, that should be independent whether she's married or divorced at this point in time. The only question is when it was lost, did he write it for her? If you say that the issue is pure own, then we can understand Rabbi Yossi's position of differentiating between being married and being divorced. And that's why we'll explain that if the issue is pure own, that there's, when she's married, we assume that there was no pure own. When she's not married, we don't assume that. But so that's why Ravina is forced to flip their positions and say, no, it's the Chachamim who say that we are not choshesh the pure own. And why are they choshesh by ketubah? They're choshesh by ketubah because of shtei ketubot. Rabbi Yossi, on the other hand, is choshesh the pure own. So he worries about the malva, and by ketubah also he worries. There's one exceptional case where he doesn't worry, and that's the case of where they're still married. In that case, there's no really reason to believe that it was pure own, and therefore he says it's okay to give back the ketubah. By shtei ketubot, he never worries about that issue. Right now, Amar Rabbi Elazar, machloket. Now, the way Rashi explains this word machloket over here doesn't mean that there's an argument, but machloket means the chaloku. Back in our Mishnah, the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says yachloku. When he says yachloku, what does it mean, or what's the definition of the word yachloku over here? Tosfos says, brings Rashi's interpretation down, he says that he's right, that the yachloku here is clearly trying to define that yachloku that we spoke about, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, what does it mean? So, yachloku is a b'shinema duki mitofes, b'shinema b'torif. When they're holding onto this document of the shtar, each one of them has a grip on the torif. The torif is the key part of the document. The key part of the document enumerates there the lender, the borrower, the amount of money, and it has the date in it. The tofes part is the boilerplate language that's at the bottom of the loan document. So if they're holding, both of them are holding along the document where they have grip on both pieces of it, that's when we say yachloku. But in a case, one of them is holding the tofes, the boilerplate piece of it, and one of them is holding the part that has all the significant information, zenoto tofes, zenoto torif. Each one of them will get the piece that belongs, that they're holding on to. The one who gets the tofes, he'll collect the tofes. The one who gets the torif will get the torif. He's holding it, he'll get the torif, he'll get the tofes. All right, we'll see in a minute, what are you going to do with it? That's what Gemara's going to ask. Okay, now that you split it in half, what's it worth to anybody? B'yochanan Amar, the Olam Chokim, that they always split it. Doesn't matter, V'afil Echad Aduk Petorif, Echad Aduk Petorif, no matter which way they're holding it, we divide the Milve and Lover, we divide it in half, we divide the loan in half, and give half to the Malve and half to the Lover, meaning that the Lover will be Chayav to pay back half of the outstanding loan. So, Vatanya, but when we have a price, it's Zeno Tad Makum Shedom Agat. Right, what about the price that says that you take them till the point that you're holding? So why does Rabbi Yochanan ignore the fact of where you're holding the document? Mark says, Lotzricha the Kai Torif Beimitzoy, that the Torah is found in the middle of this, either middle of this document, or more maybe in the middle of this piece of paper. So where they're holding has no relevance to the Torif. Since it has no relevance to the Torif, then they're not really arguing. The way the Gemara is answering over here, they're not arguing. They're actually talking about two different cases. Rabbi Elazar is addressing a case where the Torah and the Tofes are in a place where they're both holding it. And Rabbi Yochanan is addressing a case where they're both holding a document, but neither of them has their hand on the Torah because the document, the written document, is actually in the middle. So they're both holding what seems to be the margin of the document. Because they're both holding the margin of the document, therefore we split it evenly no matter what. So that, based on this explanation, they're not arguing. So Gemara says, Yochi ma the memra. What's the chiddush over here that they split it? Of course, if they're both holding on to the margin of the document, what's the reason to say that they shouldn't split it evenly? Meaning that depends how you're holding the document. You could be holding the document in portrait form. If they're holding in portrait form, that means that one of them is holding his grasp on the margin is closer to the torif, and the other one's grasp is closer to the torif. So let's say cut the line horizontally. One wound up the torif, one up the torif. So divide across that horizontal line. The other brides are going to say, no, why are you splitting along the horizontal line? Let us cut along the vertical line. We're holding it portrait. Cut down the middle line, and both of us are half the torif and half the toface. So why divide it one and not the other way? And that's what the chiddush of Rabbi Yochanan is coming to teach us. Split the amount. If we don't look or we don't consider what's closer to one party or the other party when they're holding on the margin, we just look at the document. We split the document in half. But that is not addressing or not dealing with the issue of Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar is talking about the case when they actually have physical grasp on portions of the document, like the Torah for the Tofes. So I'm going to Rabbi Achim, the Ravina, the Rabbi Elazar. Now, based on Rabbi Elazar's explanation, the Amar Zeno Totov, Zeno Tofes, Lomale. What are they going to do with these things? What are you going to do with a Torah for a Tofes after you rip the document, the contract in half? What are you going to do with it? What, he needs extra paper for corking? I mean, well, the document's now worthless when you split it in half. He says, I'm related to me. The Amar Hachi. He says, no. When we say we split it, we don't split it, literally rip the document in half. We don't rip the shtar in half and say, you get the tollface, you get the tollface. But rather we say we divide the monetary value of the document over here. So if we divide up the monetary value of the document, then we have to consider who gets more money. I mean, is one part of the document worth more than the other part? And as we says, the Torah, the person who's holding the Torah, and who would have gotten the Torah based on what he's holding, he has the date in it. A document that's dated is worth more than a document that's undated. Why? Because a document that's dated, right, gets the Isman Kama Shavi Bishtardi, Isman and Ishtar, that you have the document date in it, or the date is documented, Gabi Mishabdi, then you're allowed to collect from encumbered property. Right, the Idach, Gabi Mishabdi, a document that does not have a date in it, you do not collect from Mishabdi, then you can only take from B'nai Chori, free and clear property. You may not take it from encumbered property, or property that was already bought by the Kuchot. So there is a value differential between the Tofes and the Toreif, based on where the Zman is. So therefore we're going to go, Tosa says we're going to go and sell the document. It's not, we don't look at the face value of the loan, 1,000 shekel loan, we look at the face value of it, but rather we say, what would this document, if we sold it to a third party then to go collect this money, what would he pay for it? Then based on that, what he would pay for it, we split the money between the Malv and the Lovet. Then, then, once we split the money evenly, we say to the person who's holding the Tofes, you must pay more money to the one who's holding the Torah. You have to give up the differential to the Torah. Why? Because his half of the document's worth more than your half of the document. His half of the document has a date in it. And how much does a document with a date sell for versus how much does a document without a date sell for? That differential in price, you have to give back to him. You're going to have to give that money back to him because he holds that document. And that he's entitled to because he was holding that side of the document. Now, let's think about this more clearly. Because is it really true that the person who's holding the Torah side where all the important information is, that he has the upper hand here? Because there are a number of other things. First of all, the Torah. Number one, the Torah has all the information about the lender, the borrower, the amount of the loan, plus the date. What he is missing that's significant is the signatures. The signatures in the document are below the Torah, below the boilerplate language. So the one who's holding the Torah is holding the signatures. So now, almost in a sense, that neither of them have any document that's valid. One guy has the signatures, the other guy has the date. The guy with the signatures, he has the upper hand because he actually has the signatures on his document. On the other hand, the person who has the date in it has the upper hand because his document can collect from even from Mishabde. So Rashi answers this issue and says that the Torah is still better than the Toface because of the Zman. Why doesn't the Toface, what does he have? He has boilerplate language. He doesn't even have the lender, the borrower, and the amount of the loan. So why does he have any claim whatsoever? So Rashi says that in the last line of the document, after the boilerplate language, you're Chuzer. They repeat the language again, they repeat again who the borrower, lender, and the amount are. So since that's repeated in the Tofes, that's not a difference between the Toreif and the Tofes, because that information is found in both places. What is the difference between them? The date. The date is found in the Toreif, it's not found in the Tofes. What about the signatures? The signatures are also found only in the Tofes, not in the Toreif, so they should have upper hand for the Tofes part. So Rashi says, well, Ishum, it's the last four lines in Rashi, on the Amor, it says, Imishum Chatima Teidim, if you're worried about the signatures, do Tachana Tofes, it's only below the boilerplate language. Hayit Leila Rabbi Shimon Galel, we just learned before in the previous Amor that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel believes that Moda Bishtar Shekadvo ain't Tzarech Lekaimo. Someone, when the Lover agrees that the Shtar was existing, we don't need to Mekayim it. We don't need to hate him at all. V'ha Moda Shekadvo. And over here, he was Moda. He agreed that the Shtar is a valid Shtar. Since he agrees that it's a valid shtar, then we don't need the Edim anymore, because the Lover is one who admits that it's a good shtar, and his admission is what makes the shtar into a good shtar. Tosfos over here agrees with Rashi in principle, and he says it's true. The Tofes and Torah only have one difference between them, and that is Zman, the date. But Tosfos formulates it differently. He says that anything that would make the shtar pasul, I mean, if you remove this item from the shtar, it would make it an entirely shtar pasul, that we don't say that one party has that over the other. So we don't say that the Edim or the signature of the Edim belongs to the person holding the Tofes over the Torah, because if you take out the Edim, then the whole document's worthless. Right? He said, we don't say that the information, that's important information that's written in the Torah, like the lender, borrower, and the amount of money, that is significant, and the Tofes is worthless, because if you take that away from the Tofes has no value. So we don't look at the difference between what they're holding about something that will make the entire shtar pasul. But we look at a difference between them as something that would not make the shtar pasul, but would change the dynamic or change the value of the shtar. And the only thing that's true about is the date. If you remove the date, the document is still a valid document. And it just will have a difference about what you're allowed to collect from. So in that instance, that's all we see is the difference between the malveh and the loveh over here. The difference between the malveh and the loveh is only, or the only differences that we're going to focus on are differences when they're holding the tofes or the toref, whatever they're holding, to whoever's advantage it is, to the loveh or the malveh, whoever's holding which side of it. Right, we'll only look at issues that would, if we took them away, the document would still be a valid document. So we have a valid document, you're just missing one component. So let's look at the value of that component. That is only shayach by Zman. He brings down that the Yerushalmi actually explains it, that the Yerushalmi says that they go after the one who's holding the Edim. That the, whoever's holding the Edim, whoever holds the portion of the document that has the Edim in it, that they get more value. So he says that argues an argument over here in the Bavli. And he says that our Bavli, our Gemara over here, believes that Ede Misira Karte means that the document, the signatures on the document itself are not important. It's the Ede Misira, those that witnessed the document being given or that the loan was initiated, they saw the passing of the money. And that's what creates the Ede Misira, they saw the document being passed from the Lovah to the Malveh. Those are the ones that make the document a valid document. The fact that there are signatures on the document, that's only Mipnei Tikkun Olam. So our Bavli believes that all we care about are the Ede Misira, the Ede Chatima are not so valuable. So therefore, when the loan comes and admits to the loan, then we assume that it's the loan happened, that there were Ede Misira. We don't go try to find those Ede Misira to verify it. On the other hand, the Yerushalmi seems to believe, or Greg Tosfos is reading it, the Yerushalmi believes that it's Ede Ktiva. The Edim that are signed the dying were verified, and therefore whoever's holding those Edim has got the upper hand over here. That's why Tosfos modifies simply, or tries to explain Rashi's position of why we don't care about the Ede Chatim over here. Don't care about the Ede Chatim over here because we think that Ede Misira are what are karte. The Ede Misira are the ones that make the document valid, and since they're the ones that make the document valid, right, then we don't care about this, who has the signatures in their hand. Okay, we'll stop over here.